A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is The Guardian.
You've got the state Liberal Party of Victoria proposing legislation of a 50% target, and the federal Liberal Party saying 43% being legislated would be an affront to civilisation. I mean, the federal Liberal Party is out of touch, even with their state branches, let alone the Australian people and the broad mass of the population. I mean, they are just reinforcing how much they don't get it.
Hello, lovely people of Pods, and welcome to the show. You are with Catherine Murphy and you're listening to Australian Politics. And who else would I have on the show at the end of this week?
Is that your first question, Murph?
No, he's laughing. We didn't cue this very well. My guest this week, sorry, be professional. My guest this week is Chris Bowen, who is the Minister for Climate Change. And that's the reason I set it up in that fashion, because it's been a very big week for climate change policy. The Albanese government has got its first lot of legislation through the House of Representatives, which may not sound like much, but if you've lived in Australia for the last 10 years, is actually, in fact, a minor revolution. So anyway, I've invited Chris on to the show just so that we can talk about the events of the week and we can start to look ahead at what else needs to happen. So, Chris, why don't we start with the week? Because obviously you had the numbers to pass this legislation in the House of Representatives. You didn't, in fact, have to talk to anybody or do anything at this point in time. But you did, obviously. You spoke to the Greens and you spoke to the Teal Independents and reached a set of agreements. Why don't we bring the listeners into that picture? How did that all happen?
Well, thank you, Murph. Look, this is important legislation, as I think, you know, you and our listeners would agree. So we wanted to get it right and we want to get the process right. We've spent too long as a country buggering this up and you know, very close to a decade in particular of denial and delay. And it was just really important to get this right. And so, you know, the PM and I had the view pretty early that we should get the legislation through if it was possible to do with in keeping with our mandate and also, you know, work across the parliament and recognise, as I said to the independents at the beginning, we've got a mandate, we've got a set of policies, we're going to implement them, but I don't think I hold all wisdom about every line in the bill. You know, if there's sensible suggestions about things to improve the bill from your point of view, we'll talk. And we did. And, you know, different conversation with the Greens, different dynamic, but also I think fair to say with the national interest at its heart to get the job done.
And it was interesting too because I sat in the chamber for the debate and just watched it play out. Obviously, there were a bunch of amendments that were agreed between the government and various actors, like the individual independents and the Greens, and there were some amendments that were not agreed and therefore not accepted. Yep. And the independents voted different ways on some of those different amendments, which I sort of found quite interesting, sort of looking at the sort of, I guess, where those sort of non-government actors were positioning themselves in terms of those various amendments. But anyway, I don't want to get us stuck on that. So it's obviously passed the House. It goes now to a Senate inquiry and the Parliament doesn't sit again for another month or so. So it goes to the Senate. Are you absolutely confident that the Senate is locked in to pass this package of legislation? Because obviously when you have an inquiry, a parliamentary inquiry, Often interest groups, you know, they find problems with the bill, or there are different issues that get introduced into the conversation at that point.
Yeah.
Are you, in terms of obviously the Greens announced this week that they would support the package, is your understanding and belief that's the end of the matter, that there's no, right, so there won't be further amendments in the Senate or further dialogue in the Senate?
No, they've announced they're voting for it in the Senate, and, you know, and they will. I have no doubt about that. Look, in terms of the amendments in the House and the process, you know, I don't want to sort of go through the entire, you know, who said what to whom. That would be, you know, not right and very boring. But the general principle, I think, whenever you're negotiating anything is this. Let's agree on what the starting point, you know, we agree on these things. Let's rule out what we're not going to agree on, you know.
Yeah.
The Greens have a position on these things. The Labor Party has a strong position on these things. So let's sure talk about how we're going to manage that disagreement, you know, between Adam Bant and myself. And, you know, they're going to say what they're going to say, and I'm going to say what I'm going to say, and the Prime Minister's going to say what he's going to say. And we're going to continue to argue those things publicly. But here's the things in the middle where we might have different ways of getting there, or we might have different perspectives, but we're trying to do similar things. Let's concentrate on that and see if we can find a way where, you know, you can make a suggestion that we can incorporate, or we can make a suggestion that you can live with, and use that as the basis for the discussions. And that's the way it worked with the Greens. It's also the way it worked with the Teal independents, not just the sort of Teals from Central Casting. I say that in, you know, flippantly, you know, with no disrespect, not just the well-understood Teals, but, you know, the Helen Haynes, who's a little bit different, Rebecca Sharkey, to say, you know, we had good conversations, and they made suggestions to me. And again, there were some times where I said, look, guys, I'm just going to be really straight with you. I'm not going to agree to that, and there's no point in us talking about that any further. That's a red line that the government won't cross. Other areas where they suggested things, I said straight away, that looks fine to me. That's very sensible. I think that's a good suggestion, a good addition. And a sort of a third category where we say, look, I understand what you're trying to achieve, but I just don't think that wording will work for us. So I think the Parliamentary Council would have a problem with that. Let's you know, exchange words on that and see if we can come up with a form of words which achieves the same objective that you're trying to do in a slightly different way. And really, that was the process with the independents. And again, a similar but separate discussion with the Greens to say, well, okay, you want these things. We're just not going to agree to that. We have different political parties with a different view. We agree on those things already. That's already settled. So let's just concentrate our conversation on where we might be able to work together.
Mm-hmm. And going into this process, I'll ask this differently, actually. It sort of while you were conducting this process, was there, because the critical player, with no disrespect to other members of the crossbench, but given the Senate situation, the critical player was the Greens. Did you at any point think that there was a danger of not reaching agreement?
Oh, look, yeah, the agreement wasn't struck until the agreement was struck. So, you know, we had very good faith discussions, and I had some confidence that we would get there, you know, but it wasn't struck until it was struck the day before the legislation went through the House. So, there was always a chance where, you know, as a saying I deployed a few times in these negotiations, both with the Greens and when briefing my colleagues, we're 99% of the way there, which means we're about halfway done. You know, that last 1% can be, you know, really hard. You can agree on 99% of things, and then that last 1% can be really tricky because it's things that are important, you know, and things that are important, something that might be important to me might not be important to the Greens and vice versa. And, you know, so that last, you know, really sort of tricky negotiations can come down to just a few words here and there. So it all worked. It worked, but there was, you know, absolutely no guarantee that this was going to be pulled off. Absolutely not.
And what was the 1%? What was the most difficult?
Oh, look, again, I don't want to go through, you know, these things. It's very important that people can have frank conversations and they be discreet ones, and that's the way this was done. But, you know, again, like wording, like, you know, the Greens had some suggestions about the CCA amendment, which in the end they moved and I accepted. They had different versions to start with, you know. Yeah, as you would expect, it's an iterative process, a respectful one, a good faith one, a productive one. But, you know, one where we're coming at things from different points of view and have different starting points. That's the art of good negotiation, right? Getting people to concentrate on what they can agree on and get done for the country.
Mm-hmm. And looking, so let's look forward. You know, I don't know what the 1% was, and you, for entirely proper reasons, are not really going to go there. But obviously, if we look at what people are saying in the public domain, you know, the Greens are going to continue to pursue the issue of new oil and gas developments. That's very obvious from what they're saying publicly. Now, there's a couple of questions I want to ask you about this. I'm just interested that the UN chief this week said that the fossil fuel companies have basically got humanity by the throat at this point in time. And he said also this week that nothing could be more clear or present than the danger of fossil fuel expansion, right? This is the UN chief. This isn't the head of, you know, the International Socialist Federation. This is,
some liberals would say the same thing, but
Well, that's obviously nonsense. We can agree that's nonsense. But what I'm saying is he's not, he's not an environmentalist. You know, right? He's just making a diagnostic assessment.
He's a serious character.
Exactly. He's a serious character. Well, not that, you know, people who campaign for the environment are unserious people, but I'm just saying, right? He's the head of the UN. He's saying this. It's very stark language, and it's consistent with what a number of other agencies are saying about the dangers of further fossil fuel expansion. Do you agree with it?
Well, Murph, I think the key thing is here. I know Antonio Guterres. You know, I've worked with him in the past, and I have a lot of respect for him. So what I'm about to say is not a criticism of him or what he said. It's a statement of fact, though, about the discussion in Australia. Sweeping generalisations are not helpful. Let me explain what I mean by that, because I'm not having a go at anybody. I'm sort of laying out the complexities of the situation. You know, I 100% agree there's no new coal-fired power stations to be built in Australia. I 100% agree that new gas-fired power stations should be converted to green hydrogen ASAP, you know, as soon as practicable. That's our policy, and that's what we're doing. So to that degree, absolutely. I mean, you know, we don't want to see any expansion of that form of energy generation. It's not viable. It's not sensible. We won't be doing it to the degree that, as I said, you know, we will convert the Kurri Kurri gas plant to green hydrogen as soon as practicable. That is not overnight, and it has some challenges. It's not yet commercial, but it will happen. And, you know, whereas the Liberals were going down the coal-fired power station route, we're not, and we won't. And it's ridiculous for new coal-fired power stations. Matt Canavan and, you know, and Barnaby Joyce are still jumping up and down about them, but it's fantasy, and, you know, most sensible people know that. But at the same time, gas is going to be in the system for some time. Coal is going to be in the system for some time. Those resources have to come from somewhere. You know, there's got to be enough fuel for them. And Australia is an export country. So we take a case-by-case approach. And, you know, there's been examples of that. We're recording here on Friday. Tanya Plibersek yesterday made a rather significant decision, and good on her. You know, I today made announcements about the next phase of offshore wind, which is a new renewable source for Australia, which will be a very strong part of our energy mix going forward. So we take that approach rather than the, you know, what might be the easier thing to say is we're going to stop all this and all that straight away. I want to transition to 82% renewable economy in the first instance by 2030, and more than that after that, which is faster than what has been achieved so far, and more orderly. You know, and we need to manage the inevitable closure of coal-fired power stations more carefully than has been done in the past, both for the workers concerned and the energy mix. That's been done without due care and responsibility, and it's been too slow. Now, that is, I think, an aggressive, fast approach, but a sensible one, rather than the sort of we're going to stop all this today and all that tomorrow approach, which, again, you know, I'm not saying that being disrespectful to anyone. I'm saying we've got a massive task here. 82% renewables by 2030 is ambitious. 43% emissions reduction target, despite what, you know, some people say, is also ambitious. It's 89 months away. I think I've made that point on this podcast before. I think I might have said, you know, 91 months at that point. It's now 89 months away. It's not long for this sort of massive transition. And it's going to happen at a pace under a new government determined to make it so.
Yeah, but it's sort of a few things get conflated in this conversation, though. It's not obviously, you know, there are existing coal mines, there are existing LNG, you know, developments, and then there are new ones. Like there's two things here. Obviously, as you say, you know, these commodities are required because at this point we can't, you know, we can't just shut off fossil fuels tomorrow. The debate is whether or not you open up new facilities. Now, you've addressed that in the energy sector, but obviously there's, you know, there's broader implications here. There's whether or not you open up new gas fields, whether or not you open up new coal mines. I know you're not the environment minister before you tell me that, but it's like...
I wasn't
like...
about to actually, Murph, but I was about to make a difference.
Oh, all right.
I was about to make a okay. point that, yes, but we still are going to need these forms of energy for some time, and it's going to have to come from somewhere, whether it's an existing field or a new field. You know, take gas, for example. It's a vital feedstock for a whole bunch of industrial processes, whether it's making plastics or making glass, making cement. I'm very confident that green hydrogen is going to come forward and be viable there. It's not yet and won't be for some time. So, you know, let's not pretend that somehow or other there's a magic solution to this. Yes, we export a lot. There's existing contracts. There's a whole other debate there which we could get into. The new government's, you know, undertaking reforms there to make sure that we have a sensible set of regulatory regimes in place. But, look, there are... you will struggle to find anyone in the parliament more passionate about the transition to renewable energy than I am. That's my job, you know. I spent a lot of time thinking about it, working on it, but it's going to take time, and that means let's just have a discussion about how we manage that transition. The transition is going to occur. The previous government denied it would occur, and therefore refused to put in place the mechanisms to achieve it. That's why, partly why we're in the mess we're in. That's being fixed. It's a massive task.
Mm. What about, obviously, the Greens have said this, or foregrounded this. David Pocock said it. He's a critical player in the Senate. The issue of whether or not the government's planned overhaul of environmental law, whether or not when the environment regulations are rewritten, whether or not you insert a climate trigger or something equivalent to that in the process of assessments. If folks listening on don't understand what a climate trigger is, it's quite straightforward. It just means when big developments have their environmental approvals that the impact of climate change is factored into the assessments. Is that a viable position to consider?
Well, look, Tanya Plibersek is working through, environmental reforms. They will be something the government will consider. It won't be part of any sort of discussions or negotiations more broadly. It'll be something for the government to consider. That's a matter of public record, has been for some time. Graham Samuel brought down a review. The previous government made some response to that, but Tanya has taken the ball up and is running with it. And, you know, she's already doing a great job as Environment Minister. That's the sort of process that she has embarked upon, and that'll continue. But that'll be a government process, and you shouldn't read into that any views one way or another from me. It's a statement of fact that Tanya has a process underway, and I'll be working with her on.
But in terms of it being a government process, of course it is. That rewrite is, of course, a matter of the government. But any rewritten laws are going to have to clear the parliament. Therefore, if some of the Senate protagonists are out there basically, projecting thoughts or dispositions in relation to this, it would be a bit silly not to listen, wouldn't it?
Well, I mean, that's politics, isn't it? Yes, but I'm making the point that the government has a process to go through first, led by Tanya in this instance. We'll come up with our preferred position and then we'll argue for it. And we will navigate our way through the parliament as we have done this week on issues in MySpace.
Well, it's just note for the listeners, there's no in in response to that question. Anyway, moving on, the next big thing, obvious, well, there's so many big things, but one of the next big things is the safeguard mechanism and the overhaul of the safeguard mechanism. Now, I think you said this week, Chris, or possibly, anyway, it may not have been this week, but recently that there's a discussion paper about to emerge over the next month or so. But just a couple of questions I want to get clearer in my own mind. Does this overhaul of the safeguard mechanism, will that require legislation?
No.
You think you can do it by regulation?
Yes. Yep.
That you won't have to change the primary legislation at all?
That's right. That's right. There's one small part of the reform which will require legislation, but that is not sort of the big chunk of the policy that we took the election. It's actually, this is really important, Murph. I'm glad you've raised it, because this is a really big moving lever at our disposal, which probably doesn't get as much attention as some of the other things that are in the debate. So I'm glad you raised it. But there's one small part of the reform called below the baseline crediting, which will play, but that's actually bipartisan. Both sides of politics think that should happen. So I don't envisage that being hopefully too controversial. But the reforms that we took to the election to put the safeguards mechanism on a trajectory to net zero do not require legislation. They will be by regulation. Now, as you said, I've got a discussion paper coming out soon, as we're still working on it. It's not quite ready because there are a lot of complicated moving parts here. This is really important. Let's just go back to first principles for a second for the listeners, because I doubt everybody has followed the finer nuances of the safeguards mechanism, and nor should they. But the safeguards mechanism was put in place by the last government to sort of say, when they abolish the carbon price, but we'll make sure, don't worry, we'll make sure the big emitters don't emit anymore, because we'll have a safeguards mechanism in place which will require them not to emit more. It hasn't worked because they had the baseline so high that it was just useless. But that doesn't mean that the architecture was useless. The architecture was actually quite well designed. I think probably whether it was some bureaucrats or somebody, but somebody designed it quite well, thinking, well, one day a government might come along and might actually use it for the purpose it was designed for, and that's what we're doing. Now, how we make that change is actually quite complicated. The election promise we took was to put those safeguard facilities, there's 215 of them, if they emit more than 100,000 tonnes a year, on a trajectory to net zero. Now, there's a fair bit of choice before me, to recommend to the cabinet about how we do that. I want to consult with people. There'll be views within, you know, the industries, within the climate movement about the best way. And, you know, I have some very genuine open minds about some of the finer details, like how you set the baseline, we deal with what we call emissions intensive trade exposure.
Yeah.
Like there's a couple of options there. You'll see that when the discussion paper comes out, it's quite a genuine process. About, you know, how you deal with the different facilities of the different sectors. I think some of the complexity will be clear when that discussion paper comes out in the next few weeks.
Yeah, and obviously if you were having a genuine process, I don't expect you to have settled positions. And, you know, that would be silly, wouldn't it? But I am interested in a couple of things. Obviously under the previous government, facilities were permitted to increase their emissions, even though this was a mechanism, as you've said, right, designed to actually do the opposite. There was this practice where facilities were able to, you know, basically say, excuse me, can I increase my emissions, and the government said, yeah, sure, as you've asked me, why not? Are you envisaging that ends, that practice ends?
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the problems was that, you know, facilities could sort of trade between years, and there's some place for, you know, everybody understands there's got to be some flexibility, no issues with that, but it was sort of so loose that it did nothing. That's not primarily where the reform choices lie. The reform choices lie in sort of how you set the new baselines. Is it, again, I don't want to get ahead of, you know, what's in the discussion paper, but, you know, how much do you look at industry averages? How much do you look at particular facilities? All that's going to be in the discussion paper.
Yep. No, I know, but what I'm trying to do is get a couple of principles that can that can sit above detail, which is, you know, to be continued and to be discussed, right? So just as a point of principle, right, do you envisage setting up a scheme where someone could just opt out of their obligations?
They can choose how they reduce their emissions. You know, we're not going to come in and make those decisions for them. But, you know, they've got to be on a trajectory towards net zero. Now, there's questions about, you know, how you do that, what degree of flexibility you have. There needs to be some flexibility. You know, nobody's going to have like a straight linear line to zero and say you've got to reduce by this amount with no flexibility or else, because every facility is different. You know, we're talking here coal mines, we're talking gas facilities, we're talking aluminium smelters. We're talking, these are all facilities, not companies, with two exceptions. The Qantas and Virgin are counted as facilities, even though they're companies.
Yeah.
So they're very different to a coal mine, you know, with different technologies available to them. So that's the sort of degree of complexity we have here. We knew that, but the principle that we sort of mandated and received a mandate for is very, very clear, that we're going to put the safeguard mechanism to work. It's as I keep saying, it's real important stuff. You don't reduce emissions unless you reduce them from your biggest emitters. You know, that's pretty basic.
Yeah.
It's got to be said. The Liberal Party doesn't agree with it. Still worth being said. But we've got to get it right. That's what I'm pretty determined to do. But here's my point. You know, when I say to people, I say this in good faith, I'm not being critical, you want to call for higher targets, that's fine, that's your right. But, you know, bear in mind the complexity and the size and the task of what we're doing here. I mean, when the safeguards mechanism becomes a political football, as it will, as the Liberal Party inevitably engages in, you know, cheap politics about it, just remember the fight we're in here to get to the 43%. You know, this is not easy stuff, you know. That's fine. We're up for it. But here we are. You know, this is a very serious economic reform, the safeguards mechanism reform that we're undertaking.
Well, it's. I think, in my view, it's one of the most important things you'll do this term because it's the difference between actually achieving a 43% target and not, Ryan. But one more question of principle. You inferred this in your answer, but I just want to ask you more explicitly. Obviously, the facilities are not going to set linear trajectories that involve actual emissions reduced at facilities in this sort of straight line down, right? There's going to be a variety of actions, including purchasing offsets, yep. right? A lot of facilities will do that yep. in order to acquit their obligations.
Yes.
And if people listening don't know about offsets, that means, well, you can reduce emissions in two ways. You can actually reduce emissions, or you can buy the emissions reduced by someone else, right? That's sort of at the simplest level. So there'll be a threshold policy decision to make about that, like whether there'll be limits on the amount of emissions that are reduced by offsetting as opposed to actually reducing emissions. Have you got any of that clear in your mind? Like, will there be a limit? Like, if I am facility X, right, and I'm one of the 215, and I decide I'm going to deal with my entire emissions obligation by offsets, I'm just going to go and buy a whole bunch of offsets, will I be able to do that?
Well, again, there's a few issues in the discussion paper, I'm sure you'll be one of its most vociferous readers.
I will be a very avid reader of the discussion paper, that is true.
And good on you, and I welcome that. And you know, maybe once it's public, I can come on and talk about some of the issues again. But there will be some issues there. The point I would make is, I've said previously, offsets will be more important under us, not less important, because we are undertaking a very big, you know, emissions reduction task, and the net zero thing is important because it's zero and net. So the implication of net is there's a role for offsets. You know, most sensible people understand that. That's why, one of the reasons why we've embarked in offsets reform to ensure integrity, right? Because, I mean, it's got to be a system with integrity. There have got to be real meaningful offsets with real meaningful emissions reduction. That should be the case regardless, particularly the case if you're doing more of it. That's why we've appointed Professor Ian Chubb and the Honourable Annabel Bennett and Evan Hatfield-Dodds and Ariadne Goring. This is a very high-powered review that I've appointed to ensure the integrity of the offset system because, you know, there have been allegations made that the offset system is not fit for purpose. I have no view about that. That's why I've appointed the review. But I want to be able to look the Australian people in the eye and say, you know, we are very certain that offsets are real. And I've appointed the most, you know, unimpeachable group of individuals you could imagine
Yeah, well, look, it's a serious, a serious review with serious people doing it. But and so, you know, it's great, obviously, if the offsets are actually going to be real as opposed to, you know, something sort of generated that's sort of, you know, fake, basically. But still, like, just as just at that level of principle, can I do it entirely by offsets? Can I do it? Limits or not?
Well, I think you'll see in the discussion paper we go through how emissions intensive, trade exposed, facilities are treated, how they get some, you know, consideration for their trade exposed elements, etc., with various options. I'm getting very close to announcing it, to release it.
Yes. That'd be marvellous if you would.
But I'm not in a position to do it on this podcast because there's still some, full stops being inserted and some T's being crossed, etc. It'll be out relatively soon, and it'll be a very transparent process. You'll be able to see all the relevant sort of factors.
All the various permutations. All right, quickly, because we're really on the clock. Transport is obviously going to be really important, and you've taken the first step in terms of the reducing tariffs on EVs, which makes EVs cheaper.
Fringe benefits,
and FBT, that's true. But that in and of itself is not a transport strategy, as I'm sure you would readily acknowledge. So when are we going to see more meat on those bones? Like, you know, are you going to have vehicle emission standards, for example? Is there going to be some sort of mass rollout of technology in terms of charging stations? Where's all that up to?
Well, charging stations, yes. Yes, you're right. We've passed through the House our fringe benefits tax abolition for electric vehicles below the electric car tax threshold. That's important. Charging, yes. We promised to have a charging station once every 150 kilometres, and we will. That's an administrative thing I'm still working through, but, you know, that'll be a future announcements as to details, but that we are doing that. That's an election promise, mm-hmm. and we're getting on with it. You know, I've had discussions about how we achieve that, and that's all coming along quite nicely. Thank you very much. We'll have an electric vehicle strategy. I'll be having more to say about, you know, the sort of process around that and what goes into that. We'll convert the Commonwealth fleet to electric and hydrogen. That's important. 10,000 cars. That's important. So it's all happening, Murph. More to say about, you know, some of it, but everything we said we would do, we will do. And I've said that, you know, we'll be consulting about other elements and things that we can put into the electric vehicle strategy, and I'll have more to say.
What about vehicle emission standards?
I've previously said that everything's on the table and we'll consult broadly, and I'll have more to say about that consultation process.
Okay. All right. We're almost at the end of the time, sadly, but I just want to ask you, get us out of the weeds now and sort of look more generally. I want to ask you two questions. Obviously, because your principal dance partner, and we sort of started with this really when we were talking about the process of getting the bill through, but in parliamentary terms, your principal dance partner in this parliament will be the Greens. You've been through the first phase of a discussion with them in relation to this first bit of legislation. And obviously that's the first time you've done that in this portfolio, right? This is sort of your opening, yep. You know, your opening experience in that, right?
Yep.
So what have you learned as a consequence of that? Do you see the Greens in this parliament as a partner or an adversary or both or...
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, they're a political party which is an opponent of us, and, you know, we're opponents of them. You know, there are seats we fight for. They have a different view about many things. Having said that, you know, where we can come together on areas of mutual agreement, or perhaps I should say better, mutual objectives. You know, we're both trying to achieve similar things, but we have different perspectives. I think the key is, you know, there is a relationship there where, you know, we can at least have a conversation where we can say, look, do you think this is something worth talking about? You know, is this something we can work together on or not? You know, and if it's not, well, we won't. And if it is, we'll at least talk and we'll explore the possibilities. That's how this started, you know, frankly. I didn't expect them to walk away from any of their fundamental beliefs. I made it very clear to them we wouldn't be walking away from the key fundamentals of our policy. But I thought, and Adam Bant thought, but the Prime Minister's agreement, it was worth exploring to see where we could work together, and we did. And that's a good thing. that's a good, I think the country, you know, I think most sensible people listening would say that's a good thing for the country. We got something done this week. Isn't that a good thing? And, you know, it doesn't mean that we don't have arguments. It's been pretty clear. You know, Adam Bance said some things about us and we have different views about him, and not personally, but, you know, about his policies and his political party. That will continue. We're not here to sing, you know, Kumbaya together all the time, but we are here where we can come together for the country, and we will. And I will, you know, there'll be times when I ring him and say, do you think this is worth something we could explore working together? He might say yes or he might say no, and he might do the same with us. And look, to be fair, I'll do that with across the party, parliament, with people who want to do it, people who want to do it. I think you're right. I think, it could well be that that is the most likely combination. But it will only ever come, I think, where, you know, it's very clear that we won't be walking away from some of the things or any of the things that we believe very, very strongly. And I don't expect them to either.
It's tricky, though, just quickly, with the safeguard stuff, obviously. You know, we've clarified that most of it's a regulatory thing, but obviously, you know, the Greens and the Liberal Party could combine in different polarities, right, of objection.
Yeah, that would, the Liberals will object to any reform of safeguards because they don't believe in emissions reduction. Let's just call it. It would be, I think it would be unfortunate if the Greens, you know, combined with them because they don't like the particular way we've done it. If that's the way, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Like, it might not even be an issue, right? I've got a genuine consultation process to go through. It will be controversial. Nobody's going to read the safeguards mechanism discussion paper and go, oh, that's all very easy. Everybody's going to agree on all that straight away. Nobody's going to think that. But the things worth doing in politics are never easy. You know, if it was easy, somebody else would have done it. So that doesn't faze us. But it would be, there's always a risk that the Liberals and the Greens could combine. They could have on this legislation, but they didn't. And I will have good faith discussions again when it comes to safeguards regulations. I've said that. The Greens have said that they'll have views on our discussion paper. I've said, I'm happy to hear them. There'll be good faith discussions, but I would be disappointed if, the Greens for one reason and the Liberals for another reason combined to stop serious emissions reduction from the biggest emitters. But we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. That's a little way off yet. I think, let's end on a positive note. The Parliament showed this week what is possible. Let's not catastrophise about what might go wrong. Let's celebrate what is possible.
No, that's very, very reasonable, Council. One more question, then I know you've got to go. I just want your political head on this. I mean, obviously it's hard to be objective because you're in the middle of it. But obviously the Liberals made a big call this week by digging in and not supporting that legislation. It seems pretty obvious to me that Peter Dutton thinks that there is some universe where you can continue to weaponise in this space, and part of his calculation in not agreeing, or not coming to the table in discussions with you around this bill has been that his judgment is you and the Greens doing a deal on emissions reduction will be bad for Labor. Politically, what do you think about that?
Same old. I mean, the big part of the reason they were turfed out of the office was because they couldn't get their act together on climate. A funny way of showing that they've heard the lesson. I mean, I think they have reinforced to all those sort of, perhaps in other ways conservative voters, falsely conservative voters, but who cared about climate. Funny way to reinforce the message or to tell those voters they've got the message and they've changed, because they haven't. And, they haven't changed. It is the same people. The same people who presided over this decade are still there. And that's okay. That's okay. But after you've lost an election, at some point you've got to say, we didn't get everything right. And nowhere more spectacularly did they not get everything right than climate. And they can't say that because they don't get it. They don't accept it. With one of the exceptions, they don't accept they got it wrong. They have not changed.
Yeah. No, I'm not contesting that point. I mean, I'm an old-fashioned person who believes in right and wrong, and I believe they've been wrong for a very long time.
They're wrong.
In relation to this.
They have been wrong. But they could say, look, we get it. We had a go. We made some mistakes. One of the areas we made mistakes is climate, and we're going to change. They could say that, but they're not saying it. And so I think it's bad politics. I think it's bad for them and bad for the country, because actually the country does want climate action. But, you know, having said that, if my political opponents, the Liberal Party, want to, you know, reinforce the Australian people that they still don't get it, well, okay, way you go, guys. Do your worst.
But this is like your judgment is that the country has genuinely turned a corner on this issue.
Yeah, I mean, look, there'll always be, of course, there will always be political opportunity for cheap shots. Yes, they can do that. You know, and they can blame things on renewable energy, which is not the fault of renewable energy. They do that all the time. I mean, Peter Dutton has already done that in his relatively short period as leader of the opposition already. You know, he basically said the recent energy crisis was too much renewables. It's a lie. But it just sort of reinforces that they haven't got the message. And, you know, what you see is what you get. The modern Liberal Party is not very modern. That's what you get. They have counted themselves out. This is the biggest challenge facing the globe, the biggest economic opportunity facing the country. They've decided to plead themselves out of the conversation by not agreeing on the need for action. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You've got the state Liberal Party of Victoria proposing legislation of a 50% target, and the federal Liberal Party saying 43% being legislated would be an affront to civilization. I mean, the federal Liberal Party is out of touch, even with their state branches, let alone the Australian people and the broad mass of the population. I mean, they are just reinforcing how much they don't get it.
Okay. Well, that seems fairly comprehensive as answers go. Thank you for your time, Chris, you know, at the end of a really busy week and important week.
I will be having a beer tonight, Murph. I don't mind.
Yes, I think that's utterly fair enough. And there may be a few other, you know, veterans of the climate wars who might be having a quiet tipple as well. You never know. But anyway, thank you for joining me. I appreciate it. Thank you to Miles Martignoni, who's the EP of this show. Thank you to you guys for listening, sharing, talking, etc. We will be back next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.